The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case is 2018-1265, the State of Ohio versus Anthony Kirkland. For the appellant, Mr. McKenna.
Chief Justice O'Connor, Justices, colleagues, may it please the court. Your Honors, in this case, we have a problem in each of the three areas that I would consider and would suggest are the three most important parts of capital litigation: jury selection, the presentation of mitigation, and closing argument in mitigation. This is so because usually the facts are inflammatory, and the more important position or part of these trials are the mitigation phase or sentencing phase. The first problem in this case was right out the chute at jury selection. When the jurors are brought into a capital case, they fill out a jury selection form or jury questionnaire. It's a long form. And the state and the defense attorneys sift out the potential jurors or veneer men or women who have serious problems with capital punishment. And in this case, there was 15 jurors who were selected by counsel in the court who opposed the death penalty in any case or would automatically give the death penalty in any case. And defense counsel at the trial level requested individualized sequestered voir dire of these 15 potential jurors. Now, I concede that there is no requirement for individualized voir dire. That's up to the court, trial court. However, you simply can't excuse jurors for cause simply because they have a generalized objection to the death penalty. That's Witherspoon v. Illinois. And in this case, I think it would have been appropriate to have the individualized voir dire because we had upon review of the record, what I'm calling a groupthink effect, where once the first juror, initials PV, unequivocally said they would not do the death penalty or impose the death penalty, he or she was removed for cause. Then we started getting the same answers from other potential jurors who felt the same way. Juror number two or juror number HS objected to imposition of the death penalty. However, upon questioning by the trial judge and by counsels, that juror said they would follow the law and follow the instructions. That juror was removed. And then we had a next juror come up, PH number 27, also opposed the death penalty. Was again asked, will you follow the law? Will you consider the imposition of death if it's appropriate? And that juror said, yes. There was some more questioning. That juror was also removed. Of the 12 jurors who indicated they opposed capital punishment in any case, 11 of them were removed for cause. Of the three jurors who indicated that they were automatically in favor of capital punishment during a murder, 2 of 3 were removed for cause. So we have a situation where it's very difficult for the defendant, Mr. Kirkland, to get a jury that is fair. The jurors that are more inclined to not, or who would take imposing the death penalty most seriously and were more opposed to it were removed, where jurors who were more inclined or more in favor to give the death penalty stayed on. And had there been an individualized voir dire, this process would have been more thorough and we would not have had this groupthink effect in answers, and I think it would have been a more just, fair process. Also during this jury selection, the state said that the jury shall recommend death. It should have been shall. Or excuse me, the state said this, your verdict is a recommendation of death. The defense attorney objected that the person would be put to death if they voted on that. And the court corrected it, but it was out nonetheless.
Well, counsel, it is a recommendation. The court is not bound by the jurors finding that death is a potential for the court to impose?
That's correct, Your Honor. But
so then why is the word recommendation insufficient?
I would suggest that it leaves the jury with the impression that it's not going to happen.
It gives them an impression that that is an alternative, that is one consequence.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, that's true. It is one consequence.
It is a consequence, Judge. I think that it makes the jury, it gives the jury a sense that perhaps it won't happen and perhaps they would take it less seriously in their voting. That's all I was suggesting.
And what do you base that on?
Just making an inference that it's just human nature that this might not happen is if I vote on this. Nonetheless, I would also bring up during the jury selection, there were some other issues. First of all, in the jury questionnaire, there was a warning on the cover page that their information could be released to the media. There was also a statement that identifying information would not be used. And trial counsel objected to this, and we are arguing that this created a chilling effect on the answers from the jury. Because the jury, and again, this is a human nature argument, that a person who thinks their information is going to be released might not be fully honest or give full disclosure as to their opinions on a questionnaire.
Counsel, wouldn't the same be true in court, in front of the public? People are answering questions. Isn't the same issue?
It is in court, Your Honor. What I'm suggesting, though, is that they're more guarded as they're writing the answers, and defense counsel and the state, for that matter, have to ask probative questions based on their responses on the jury questionnaires. You get those questionnaires before trial starts, and you start preparing your questions based on what they responded. So if they didn't answer the questions forthrightly or perhaps openly, you're not getting a full, honest voir dire.
But you can ask them questions.
You certainly can, Your Honor. Yes.
Follow up. I mean, I guess I just don't want to see people, you know, the length of the questionnaire. You could ask that technically to every juror without handing them the questionnaire.
You could, Your Honor.
And that would just take up.
It would take a lot more time.
It
would take more time if you did that, went through it. I think for economy, it would be better to have the answers written out. But yes, I see what you mean.
So, counsel, they were instructed that their identifying information would not be disclosed, but the contents of their questionnaire potentially could be released. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. If they were in the jury room or in the courtroom and being questioned, it would be on the record.
Correct.
Their identification, presumably, would be there on the record.
We'd use a number.
Okay. So, you know, the public is admitted to the courtroom at that time, correct?
Correct. I would submit to the court that it goes more towards a full voir dire, Your Honor, of the attorneys being able to be prepared to ask the questions. To go back to what Justice Fisher asked, it would require a much longer process of asking questions.
What would?
If the jury was not forthright, potential jury was not forthright in their questions on the questionnaire.
Their answers to the questionnaire, you're saying, are suspect. But they don't get the question. When do they get the questionnaire, the response? When do the defense attorneys and the prosecution receive the questionnaires?
Prior to the questioning of jury selection.
How far in advance?
Usually it's a few hours. Now, on regular trials, or what I'll call a run-of-the-mill trial, you might get it in an hour, but during capital litigation, you get it, and they'll say, we'll start in a few hours after you've had a chance to review it, or sometimes even the night before.
Okay, so there's ample time for the attorneys, and how many different questions are there to ask a juror on issues of bias, and, you know, especially if they say, either I'm categorically opposed or, you know, death is an appropriate penalty if anybody takes the life of another. And those are the two areas that are subject to inquiry most often.
Yes, Your Honor.
And they're the ones that you're, you know, you've zeroed in on. You know, there's only so much you can do with that.
I agree, Judge. Yeah. Finally, in the jury selection phase, error or suggested error is the right to impartial jury was violated here. We had a juror number 36 who indicated on the questionnaire that she was always that agreed that the death penalty should always be used as punishment, which obviously is a big problem. This court, you know, a few weeks ago decided the Bates case with similar bias, but it was race. I'm suggesting here the bias was for the death penalty. And we have a situation where defense counsel did not go far enough into inquiry on this. They did ask a questioning how this juror felt about the death penalty. And during questioning, she admitted that, yes, she wrote, "I agree that the death penalty should always be used as punishment in murder." And then later she said, "Well, now I'm not so sure." However, counsel then said, "Well, I don't want to put you on the spot." They simply didn't go far enough in their questioning. So we have a juror who has written on their questionnaire agree that capital punishment should always be used.
Well, that's not what she said, though, when she was questioned, right? She said that it should be used in some cases, right?
She eventually said that, Your Honor. She first said that, yes, I did write that. I did write that I agree. And then as she was questioned, she said, "Now I'm not so sure. Maybe it's some cases." But then we had defense counsel stop the questions, and he said, "I don't mean to put you on the spot," and never pursued that. So we're left with conflicting answers. We have a written response of "should always be used," and then a verbal response of "I'm not sure," and it was not followed up on. And because of that, we have a juror that potentially is significantly biased towards imposition of capital punishment.
I hear you, counsel, but let me ask this. Do you want this court telling defense counsel how far to go in examining a potential juror?
Well, you know, I would suggest, you know, the rationale that was recently used in Bates, I mean, you don't know what the client told the defense attorney as to who to pick for a jury.
But in Bates, there was no follow-up question. That was the issue, right?
Correct.
And here there was follow-up of some type.
Well, there was some questioning, but ultimately the defense counsel said, and I'm sorry to repeat myself, but said, "I don't mean to put you on the spot," because I think you can read from the record the juror was getting uncomfortable, that she was perhaps switching her position or perhaps not. So we just don't know from the record if she actually switched her opinion. So we have on the jury, I mean, the record shows we have on the jury.
But trial lawyers always make tactical decisions on the fly when they're questioning a potential juror, right? Because sometimes you don't want to offend them. They might be on.
That's correct. I mean, when you're picking a jury, you have to read the jurors face to face. You have to feel the room. You have to see how the responses are. But nonetheless, we're left here with the record. And on its face, check mark, I agree, capital punishment should always be used. That's what I'm suggesting, that we very much have a juror who was biased.
And did that juror was seated?
Correct.
And there was no attempt to exclude for cause?
No, Your Honor.
By the defense attorney?
No. So they were not kicked off, no.
Okay, and there was no peremptory challenge used?
No,
Your Honor. So you have to presume for some reason that defense attorney didn't think that person would be a bad person to have on the jury for their client.
You would have to assume that they made that decision, yes, but
because they had two opportunities to do so and they failed to exercise them.
That is correct, but nonetheless, I'm suggesting that counsel was ineffective for failing to do so, and asking the court to review that because of her written response. Beyond jury selection, those are the errors in the jury selection. The errors then that occur during mitigation phase primarily relate to the remand of the case, in that this case was remanded for victims Kenny and Crawford, not for Rollison and Newton. Yet the state put on extensive testimony related to the two victims who were not remanded, whose counts were not remanded. What we have here is a violation of 404B and related statutes that prevent this. Presenting the evidence as to the two on the counts of the victims that were not remanded can only serve to inflame the jury. It's a very basic violation. You cannot use these prior acts to inflame the jury to show conduct in conformity therewith. And what we have here is police testimony was extensively used to discuss the Rollison and Newton murders, which were graphic. I know you've seen this from review of the record, and as well as the photos, which were extraordinarily graphic. This court had a case recently, State v. Thomas, where there was plain error, where a prosecutor admitted knives not used in the crime, and this court found that it was unreasonable and probably affected the outcome. Here we have the same thing, and beyond a 404B, the state should not have used the evidence from Rollison and Newton victims, because guilt or innocence was not at issue. It was a sentencing remand. So therefore, it shouldn't have even come up. We had a situation where they're presenting extraordinarily graphic photos, and just, I won't go through them all, but just to highlight the situation they're talking about, skulls that are defleshed and maggots and animal activity is quite gruesome. And there was a significant amount of photos. Defense counsel at the trial level attempted to keep these out as well as testimony out, but it kept coming up, and I don't know how any other conclusion could be made.
Counsel, your client was already convicted of the murders at this point.
Yes, Your Honor.
All four.
Correct.
Okay. And so you're in the mitigation phase.
Correct.
And isn't the one of the considerations, or I guess one of the things that the jury had to consider, was this was multiple murder as an aggravating circumstances.
Correct.
So four murders.
Correct, but that could have been done simply by presenting a certified copy of the conviction, of the prior convictions.
So your issue is the fact that there were photographs and descriptions of the bodies.
Correct.
As opposed to just an admission, a stipulation that there was a conviction for four individual murders.
Correct. I understand the state has to prove show the four for what you just mentioned, Your Honor. But the extraordinarily lengthy and graphic presentation of the Rollison and Newton murders just simply wasn't necessary. There's no other thing that could have happened to a juror from seeing this horrendous and inflammatory evidence than to be upset and to impose the death penalty. I would suggest that the court abused its discretion in allowing in the photos, and there should not have been testimony from the detectives on these murders. Also, during mitigation, in terms of error, we have misconduct by the state. And the standard under State v. Smith is fairly straightforward. Were the remarks improper? And if so, were they prejudicial? First, I think the errors were somewhat egregious. We have where the prosecutor is speculating how one of the victims died. And said, at this point, she is probably praying to God, as vomit filled her throat, please let me die. And the defense counsel objected, but trial counsel overruled, and then the state went on to say, this is what this little girl went through. Now, in the prior Kirkland decision, this court already took the state to task for stating what the victim was thinking at the time of moments before death, that is calculated to mislead the jury and is prejudicial. And I would suggest that the same thing happened here. That was an extraordinarily improper comment to make as a threshold consideration, and it had to be prejudicial. It's a very inflammatory statement to have the jury picture what admittedly would have been a horrible death, but you can't do that. It's a calculated statement to mislead the jury.
Wasn't there testimony that there was maybe well over 10 minutes it took for this child to die?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm not.
And she was being strangled?
Correct. I'm not contesting that, that the evidence was put on. I'm simply saying that the state is not allowed to, or the state should not be using these inflammatory statements in closing to inflame the jury, and that's what they did. The jury heard the evidence.
And so even if we agree with you, you know, in Kirkland 1, we said we can still correct those errors in our independent evaluation. Would that not be the case here?
I don't think it's the case here because it's a sentencing remand and not a guilt remand. We already have the guilty findings. So the issue is, what is the sentence going to be? And the sentence, the mitigation phase is very emotional, and that's why I think closing arguments are particularly important. There's study after study that potential jurors, citizens do not like serving on capital cases because they're difficult. You're deciding life or death. So when the state uses such inflammatory arguments, speculating what a victim's thinking moments before death, that crosses the line. I just think you make the inference that if someone hears that, you're going to be upset and you're going to want to punish that person. It definitely is an inflammatory fact pattern. There's no question. The other statement that was improper, perhaps not quite as egregious as the first one, though, was the state kept saying that the defense made arguments that Kirkland was abused as a child, and then repeated and said, you know, why doesn't defense counsel subpoena witnesses? Because they don't exist. Under State v. Hawkins, the state cannot make inflammatory attacks about the theory of the case on counsel. And if you take this kind of to its conclusion, it almost suggests that somehow defense counsel was being disingenuous with the jury by not subpoenaing witnesses. If, for example, if they existed, they should have done it. The state's not allowed to comment on the defense theory of the case. They can attack it, but saying where's the witnesses, I would suggest, was prejudicial.
Is that just a way of saying you've got no evidence in front of you, ladies and gentlemen, as to the allegation that he was a victim as a child?
I think saying it in a professional manner, as you just did, Judge, you know, there's no evidence that shows this, as opposed to making grandiose inflammatory statements of, where are the witnesses? Where are they? They don't exist. They didn't subpoena them. I think the way that it was presented makes the remark improper and prejudicial. And a more egregious statement was personally attacking the defense witnesses from mitigation. They used a person called Dr. Wu, who testified extensively on the conditions of Mr. Kirkland's brain and various reasons he had problems in his amygdala due to childhood trauma, et cetera. And the prosecutor said, I have never personally seen anyone I would hold in less repute than him. And there was an objection, and the statement was withdrawn, but the cat was out of the bag. State v. Hessler, the state cannot simply belittle witnesses or deride the defense. They cannot make personal attacks. It would have been appropriate for the state to attack the conclusions of Dr. Wu, his professional conclusions, but simply to say, I have never personally seen someone I held in less repute is certainly an improper comment. The question is it prejudicial for the second problem of this misconduct calculation? And I would suggest that it is, because I would remind the court we're only at this trial for sentencing. It's not about guilt or innocence. So the mitigation was extraordinarily important. In fact, it was the issue to consider. So when the state is using its time, its closing, to personally attack someone, the juror hears that. And when they reference how experienced they've been in court and they've never seen someone so bad, that's an improper and prejudicial remark. Finally, I would mention, in terms of the primary errors during mitigation and closing, some ineffective assistance of counsel issues. And I would revert, follow up, or go back to the juror number 36, where they simply did not pursue, did not question the views properly or enough or thoroughly enough on the juror's views on the capital punishment as to whether or not she would impose the death penalty, simply stopping the questioning with, "I didn't mean to put you on the spot." I would mention that also there was...
Counsel, you have 5 minutes left if you're...
I'll reserve that for
counting
rebuttal.
...counting for rebuttal. You can continue to go. I'm not saying that you can't, but I just wanted to keep track of your time for you.
Thank you, Judge. Or Your Honor, excuse me. I will just conclude with mentioning the mitigation. Defense counsels actually did do a good job in mitigation in the sense that they put on a psychologist and a psychiatrist. That was good. They brought up brain issues. They brought up effects of behavior. What they didn't do then was follow through and tie it up and bring it home, because the prosecutor in closing attacked that there was no family members to back up the abuse from childhood or medical reports when Mr. Kirkland was in the University of Cincinnati Medical Center. Had they brought those two in, it really would have tied mitigation together, and I would suggest the death penalty would not have been imposed. Thank you.
Mr. Springman?
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. And reviewing the record of this case and many of the errors are propositions of law raised by defense counsel, this trial court judge was very meticulous, always held a hearing, always heard from both sides before making a decision. And until I get questions, I'll just briefly go in order that defense counsel did in his presentation. First of all, defense counsel was concerned about the individually sequestered voir dire of the 15 jurors who indicated that they may have an issue with the death penalty. Counsel's correct. Three of them said the death penalty is automatic or should be automatic if the defendant commits murder. And 12 of them said that they have some personal philosophical belief that prevented or substantially impaired their ability to sit on a death penalty case. When reviewing all of those during questioning, it's very clear that the 12 that were moved, or the 11 that were removed for cause, were clearly against the death penalty and would not impose it under any circumstance.
Also, inference, or I guess the observation by opposing counsel, that there was a group think going on. One person said it and was excused, and then it snowballed after that. But in fact, the attorneys were working off of statements that were contained in the questionnaire. Is that true?
That is correct, Your Honor. What happened is there were some preliminary questions where jurors were brought in as a group, and they were asked if anyone had an issue with the death penalty, and these 15 did raise their hands, and so they wanted to question them further about their views. So these were people.
Did they make statements in their written responses that reflected what they said in the courtroom?
Yes, there's going to be the questionnaire, and in the questionnaire, that's where the attorneys find out in the questionnaire what the jurors, how they feel about the death penalty.
Okay, so if someone says, you know, I believe that death penalty is appropriate anytime a murder is committed, that's in the questionnaire response.
Well, there's the juror questionnaire has a number of different questions, and that's one of them. Do you agree that the death penalty is appropriate in every murder? And the jurors can check strongly agree, disagree,
okay,
and so on.
My point is, how do you get groupthink if they've already made that statement before they heard what other group members were saying? They had already made that declaration in their written questionnaire.
Exactly, Your Honor, and that's exactly correct. And I also think that when the jurors came in, there wasn't groupthink because you had the jurors stating different things. And actually, you had some jurors who had different viewpoints than others. So in the context of even that actual hearing and the questionnaires, I just don't see how there was any groupthink amongst any of the jurors here at all. The record just does not demonstrate that. And again, this court would have to overrule longstanding precedent that in Ohio, you do not have to question jurors and sequestration. Here, these 15 that raised their hand were questioned separately. Another issue involved juror 36. And I would just point out that what was kind of interesting is not only did the court ask a general question about this juror's views, and this juror clarified that she doesn't believe in the death penalty in every case, because as we remember, what's happening now, these jurors really don't know a whole lot about the law. They're being educated on the law and death penalty law in Ohio and what specific types of cases are eligible for the death penalty. They're being informed by that through the trial court, through the prosecutors, through defense counsel. So now they're getting new information about how the death penalty works in Ohio, and the goal is to see if they can follow the law. So with juror number 36, defense counsel did address her directly and noted that she checked, agreed that the death penalty was appropriate in every case. And then defense counsel said, I think you listed the death penalty as necessary. And she said, yes. And then defense counsel said, do you mean necessary in some cases, all cases? And she quickly said some, very quickly. She clarified just some cases. Like she understood now what the law is, that the death penalty clearly is not automatic in every case. Because it's interesting, because defense counsel followed up and said, thank you for correcting me so quickly that you do not believe that the death penalty is appropriate in every case. So it was a pretty strong statement that juror made to defense counsel. So defense counsel, I believe, not only directly addressed this issue with juror 36, but received some very strong feedback that juror 36 completely realized that the death penalty is not automatic in every single case. And that's why you can draw an inference as why she was left on the jury and a peremptory challenge was not used to strike her. The other acts evidence, I would just remind the court that in Kirkland 1, Mr. Kirkland pled guilty to the Rollison and Newton murders. And then we had the trial on the murders pertaining to the two juveniles. So we have the same situation, really, in this case as we had in Kirkland 1. There was a plea of guilty. Those cases were done with, but the state still had to elicit the evidence on the murders of the two adult women in order to prove the course of conduct death specification. So there really was no difference between the two procedurally. And so I just wanted to remind the court that he did plead guilty to those prior to the first trial. And yet, at the first trial, there was substantial evidence admitted.
Well, the objection from what information was just given to us, it's they could have stipulated to that. They could have introduced the convictions. They didn't have to introduce the graphic pictures in the testimony about the condition of the bodies.
Your Honor, I would submit that in this case that the prosecution was entitled to present evidence on the setting of the case, on the motive, on the modus operandi. We're dealing with a serial killer who's committing these murders in a similar fashion. He's preying on vulnerable people.
But the conditions of the bodies, because of the elements, the nature, subsequent to their death.
Yes.
That information was introduced for what purpose?
I think it was just to establish the entire setting of the case and how.
Well, how's that relevant? What?
Well,
the rate of decomposition or the, animal, or any of that stuff.
Well, it was relevant. I would, first of all, the state had to introduce course of conduct, and these murders were committed very similar to the murders of, you know.
I understand that, but the information I'm talking about is post-mortem.
Yes.
That the Kirkland had nothing, he didn't cause it. In other words, he didn't facilitate the decomposition and you know, all of the other features that were explained and brought in on the mitigation phase.
I would submit, Your Honor, in the context of this case, that would not be so overly inflammatory when a jury is already receiving a substantial amount of evidence about the horrific deaths.
What's the purpose of it? What purpose does it serve? Why should there be anything in a case that is as heinous as this is that doesn't go to the crime itself?
I think it's like if we take this into a 404B context, I think it would demonstrate the motive of the defendant. It sets out the foundation, and yes, perhaps some of the other evidence that about her body, the body's decomposing. I would submit that that's not inflammatory, but you're right. I don't know that that played a substantial or inflammatory role that would affect the determination or outcome of this case.
I guess if it does, you're saying you don't think it's inflammatory, but it doesn't play any other key role.
It's just informing the jury of his course of conduct, and we're explaining the course of conduct and the type of killer he is. That's what is relevant about much of that evidence.
That he purposely wants to be sure the bodies get decomposed and have maggots in them? That's part of the crime?
Part of that is, that's not part of the substantive crime itself, but I think the jury was entitled to know that he conducted this spiritual ritual where the
that was with the burning.
And he would, he attempted to hide evidence and so forth. But as far as some of the evidence of the bodies decomposing, I believe that everyone just used that as part of that was his course of conduct, and that's what he did. That's what investigators uncovered, and I think was for that purpose. Again, when you're talking about two juveniles that were murdered in this fashion and two others in a similar fashion, that evidence seems to give the jury a picture of what occurred, and they've already been seeing a tremendous amount of inflammatory evidence because of Mr. Kirkland's actions, not because the state was trying to inflame the jurors' passions. They just wanted to give the jury a complete picture of what occurred. And he did engage in a course of conduct where he killed two or more people, and they were entitled to know that. And, that's why it was admitted.
What about the autopsy pictures?
There were autopsy pictures admitted in reference to the two juveniles. And, the jury was well aware that two others were murdered. I'm trying to find out hard how that would be inflammatory.
I think there was at least one picture where a skull was pulled back. I mean, what's the purpose of the jury seeing that picture?
We were relying on the, I think the jury was entitled to know the cause and manner of the death of the two adult women as well, and the coroners, the deputy coroners that testified, indicated on the record that those pictures were necessary to, in their findings and conclusions and how they established the cause and manner of death.
Let me ask this question, and I know this didn't happen, but if the defense had stipulated to the cause of death, not necessarily stipulating to being the cause or
right.
Mr. Kirkland being, but stipulated to the cause of death, would any of those pictures have been necessary?
That's a difficult question, because when it comes to stipulations, the concern on the state's part is always that you're not giving the jury enough information or enough evidence. And then we're always concerned sometimes on appeal in situations where you stipulate that we miss putting enough evidence on an element of a particular offense. And so that might have prevented that from coming in. Again, I'm speculating it might have, though.
What about the comments, as defense counsel noted, on in the closing argument, the disparaging comments about Dr. Wu?
Well, the prosecutor withdrew them, but I think as the prosecutor was discussing Dr. Wu, the prosecutor clearly was relying on record evidence because Dr. Wu's testimony was completely discredited. And the,
well, but isn't that up to the jury to decide?
And that's what the prosecutor said after the objection was raised. The prosecutor withdrew the remarks and said, it's up to you, jury, to decide the credibility of Dr. Wu. So that was said to the jury by the prosecutor, you know, mitigating any possible inflammatory
But after he said he's voodoo science, that he's not credible.
Your Honor, to be honest, the Dr. Waxman, I know he didn't use the words voodoo science or junk science, but he came about as close as you could to using, and because it wasn't based on sound scientific methods or principles, it wasn't. But he came awful close to saying that.
Counsel, what about the statements by the prosecutor about what one of the victims was thinking at the time that she was dying? Is this not just like the statements that we've already said? You can't make these statements.
First of all, Your Honor, I would point out that that was an isolated remark. And when you look at it in context and you look at the evidence that was introduced in this case, as I noted, I think in my brief, is the coroner testified that Esme Kennedy, it was a horrific death. We know that there were substantial injuries that clearly demonstrated that she was raped. We know that there was vomit filling her mouth when she was dying. We know that her fingers were gripping the ground when she was dying. And so the prosecutor in that context and is discussing nothing but what's in the record, use the words, something to the effect she might be praying that she would die, and that was it. It was one statement. And I would submit that you could properly draw an inference when you know the facts, when you know that this was a prolonged death, when you know that this was a horrific rape and all that entailed. I find it hard to believe that remark on this evidence was so inflammatory.
But would you say it was error to say it, that the prosecutor should not have said it? I mean, we've repeatedly said that the prosecutors can't speculate about what a victim was thinking when she died. And in the Kirkland case, we said, you can't do this.
Your Honor, and I would add, I was on the Ralph Lynch case, and that involved a grisly death of a young girl, and where he strangled her, and there was an isolated reference about what the victim was thinking. And again, we had the same thing. The court did find error, but found that it was isolated. We're subjective here. It just doesn't seem to be as inflammatory based upon the evidence surrounding her death. But yes, you are speculating.
But you concede it's inappropriate. It's improper.
Saying that she was praying, you're drawing an inference. Yeah, it's not in the record. You're saying what's in the mind, and you don't know what's in her mind. You are taking all that evidence, and you're making one remark that she's probably praying.
And yet prosecutors across the state continue to do it with, I guess, the assumption that the court will say it's inappropriate, the court will say you shouldn't have done it, but in the scheme of things, it was harmless.
Your Honor, I hope that's not the mentality going in. These trials get emotional, and especially when you have a case like this, you can't engage in any pattern of misconduct. And in this isolated, you know, incident. Again, I struggle, as you do, because I normally would have responded that that remark might have been better left unsaid. I just really have trouble saying that on this record, because the jury is thinking, must be thinking the same thing.
They might be.
Poor girl. You know, it might, and you're right. It's I understand exactly where you're coming from. Mm-hmm. And, the prosecutors here were refrained. They were well aware of what happened in Kirkland 1 and in other cases. And I don't think there's an attempt to try to think that the court's going to just use the second prong of the prosecutorial misconduct test and say it's not prejudicial. I really don't. I hope that's not the case. And I don't think. I think the court has sent a message loud and clear about what's appropriate in closing argument. And since Wogenstahl, I think it's fairly clear to prosecutors, what evidence to stay away from. But again, it's really hard because you're asking the jury to impose death. And sometimes I know we're supposed to focus on the aggravating circumstances, the aggravating factors. And then we do that. And they were focusing on the aggravating factor of this being a rape and this horrible case. And then something like that, it's just sometimes that line is just very difficult to know where to go and where not to go. And it does involve a little bit of element of subjectivity. If the prosecutor went on and on about how the victims were just being tortured, that's a different story. That's clearly a pattern of misconduct. But really, we're one of the few states that really limits closing argument for prosecutors, because we only can focus on the aggravating circumstances. That's Ohio law, and I know it's been a struggle for prosecutors in the past, but everyone, I think, is pretty understands Wogenstahl and what has followed Wogenstahl and what we should stay away with, and everyone tries their best. Is there any other questions that I may answer the court? Well, thanks for considering my arguments.
Thank you. Counsel, you have a little over 4 minutes left.
Chief Justice and Justices, I would rebut that these errors were prejudicial and they were caused by the state's actions. On these photographs and testimony, they presented extraordinarily gruesome evidence, and I encourage you to look at the
counsel. The pictures you're talking about are the ones that were at the site of the finding of the bodies, correct?
Finding of the body and the autopsies, yes.
Okay, and so in the area where the bodies were found, there was evidence that they were burnt?
Correct.
Okay, and so it would be appropriate for forensics to take pictures of the corpse in the natural setting where they were found, would it not?
It would have, but not to the extent.
Okay, let me finish. And to depict in those pictures what happened to the bodies, as was evidenced by the burning that was evident, correct? And in the course of taking those pictures, the state of the bodies with the decomposition, maggots, etc., was part of it.
Judge, I would disagree. The maggots could have been washed off or removed and then the burnt picture taken.
And you don't think your side would have yelled about messing
painting
with...
Painting the scene if something like that happened?
Well, maybe you present one photo, but not all the photos that were given. And the other error is they presented photos of the two victims who were not remanded. There were significant photos of Newton and Rollison, and I won't go over it, but it's in the brief. They're quite gruesome. And the only reason to do that is to inflame the jury. I don't know what other reason it could have been in there. And then the same thing with the comments at the end. I mean, the comments that were made were directly contra to what this court has ordered not to do. And, you know, a jury is very sensitive. It's no juror wants to inflict or be there and give capital punishment, and all of a sudden you have the state arguing of how inflammatory this is and how the little girl's praying before she's dying, and you have to put yourself in the jury, you know, in the trial room. That would have been...
Well, the jury's just heard all the facts, though. I mean, does saying that she was praying before she's dying add anything? I mean...
Well, it does, Judge. I mean, it goes against, you know, this court's prior ruling in Kirkland. You can't comment on, you know, the thoughts moment before death. I just think it was prejudicial. It certainly was improper, but it was prejudicial because it leads the jury in a way that state is not supposed to by making that inflammatory emotional argument.
Counsel, if you take that argument, that statement is that she was probably praying to die. If you take that away, there you have to agree there was sufficient evidence, even removing that, that allows the jury to make the findings it did.
Well, I would just remind the court that we were not talking about guilt or innocence. It's only about the punishment.
I know that.
And that's why that was particularly egregious. I don't know that there was enough to find capital punishment. That's what we're arguing, that there wasn't. And if you add up all the mitigation and take away and, you know, balance it with the other factors, that there was not enough to put this man to death. Beyond that, if there's no further questions, I'll submit. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. We will take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision.